Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, how are Americans adapting to working remotely? But up front, the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials is estimating the state's schools may have a revenue shortfall of $1 billion next year. In these unprecedented times, that's just an estimate. It could be worse or it could be better. So what's that mean for schools, students, and taxpayers? Joining us on this segment of the program is Hannah Barrick, Assistant Executive Director with the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials. Hannah Barrick, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Ms. Barrick, what are the factors that lead to $1 billion in losses, at least the estimate of that?
Sure. Well, so during the sort of past couple of weeks, as school districts have been working to basically redevelop their budget for next school year, for 2020-21, in the midst of this new reality of COVID-19, there's a lot of uncertainty. And we went through the process of trying to identify for school districts, at least via estimates, what the impact might be on school district local revenue. So a lot of school districts get a lot of their revenue from local sources, in addition to state and federal sources as well. So we tried to look at recognizing there's pretty massive unemployment happening right now. We looked at the impact on earned income taxes, which some school districts collect, most school districts actually collect. We looked at the impact on property tax collection rates as sort of anticipated challenges taxpayers are likely facing as a result of this. We looked at realty transfer taxes. We looked at some of the other local services taxes. And we looked at things like investment earnings that we know school districts, some of them rely on for some of their local revenue. And it kind of, to sort of do this review, we went back and examined what happened after 2008, after the Great Recession there, and looked at each of those individual components of school district local revenue, sort of examined what those trends were, how long it took to recover, what the sort of immediate implications were for school districts. And then we did a lot of work looking at how is this particularly different right now than what we saw before, and made a couple of assumptions. One assumption was a little bit quicker recovery time frame, and one assumption was a little bit slower recovery time frame, and to sort of create a range of potential impact just on the local level for school districts. And so overall, we found that we are anticipating, at least as of right now, with the information that we have, about an $870 million to more than $1 billion impact for 2021 just in that school district local revenue. That's not even considering what certainly could happen with state funding to schools, and we know there's a little bit of a federal revenue component as well.
This is an unprecedented time. You said that you used the model somewhat of the Great Recession of 2008. Is that a good model? I mean, at that time, we were looking at unemployment rates of about, I don't know, tops of maybe 10, 11%, where now there are parts of this state that have unemployment rates well over 20%. So is that a good model?
Well, so we went back and we looked to see what happened in every individual school district as a result of that, just to kind of inform the trends in local revenue following that event. We certainly recognize that this is a lot different. And so we have experienced over 6 weeks what it sort of took years to experience following 2008. So it is a very different component. And so we made adjustments to our assumptions based on what we're seeing with respect to unemployment, based on what we're seeing with respect to sort of homes, things like that. So it is informed by what happened in 2008, but adjusted for what we are seeing right now.
You know, every year, and I often wonder how school districts, actually any kind of local government body, estimate their budget, because there are a lot of assumptions of what funding will be coming in, a lot of things that maybe can be unanticipated, like, for example, where we are right now. So there's a lot of uncertainty for school districts in a normal year. How can a school district, how can a school board come up with a budget at this time?
Yeah, I think there's probably more uncertainty with the 2021 school district budget than there may have ever been at any other time. So in addition to the uncertainty with local revenue, we don't know what's going to happen at the state level with state revenue. We know the state is dealing with their own financial challenges as a result of this. We don't know if the state budget's going to come in one part or two parts, when that's going to be. There's questions about federal stimulus funds and how those will be applied. There's also a lot of very legitimate questions about what does the school year look like next year? Can we open as normal? What changes and what costs associated with those changes will need to be made to ensure that the schools can operate in a healthy and safe manner, sort of given the fact that we're sort of going to be continuing to deal with COVID-19 for a long time. So I think at all fronts, there is uncertainty, never more than before, making the job of school leaders extremely, extremely difficult right now. So, you know, prior to COVID-19, you know, everybody worked through a budget process, which for school districts begins in the fall. They went through the process, started to build their 2021 budget. Governor introduced his proposal back in early February. COVID-19 hit, and they basically had to start over because the world is a completely different place. And so there are certainly more unknowns than there are knowns at this point, and it is a really, really difficult place for school districts to be in.
I want to touch on a number of the factors that you just brought up, but I've heard some people say, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, that schools should be saving money now since the buildings are closed, there are no buses running, probably not feeding as many of the students. That has to save some money. Was that part of the calculation, and does it save some money?
Well, so I think the reality is that there was a piece of legislation that was passed sort of to respond to this. And while some school districts might be saving some money, others we know are sort of operating and anticipating ending 2019-20 with a deficit. So one of the pieces of legislation that was passed immediately following COVID-19 required school districts to pay all employees. So there's no savings on that side, and that's really the biggest part of a school district budget. So not a lot of savings there. They had to continue to pay charter schools and IUs for students and career and technical education centers. So all those contracts that were in place for sort of paying for students, those didn't change. Those didn't go away. So those had to continue. There certainly are some school districts that were made the decision not to pay school transportation contractors, but there's also a provision in that language that allowed them to renegotiate that contract. We know that some of them have, with the idea that they would be able to maintain drivers and things like that whenever school districts opened up eventually, and sort of to deal with the subsidy issues. So while there are, you know, some very pretty limited areas where school districts could save money, we also know that during this time frame, a lot of school districts ended up with a lot of unanticipated purchases, particularly for technology and other things like that, to ensure that they could provide continuity of education during this period of closure. And that was something very much unanticipated. Additionally, you had mentioned feeding students. And so a lot of school districts are feeding all their students, and they've opened up their meal service programs and food distribution programs to any student in the district. So there's questions about how that reimbursement will work, if that reimbursement will work. So I think while the sort of assumption is that school districts might be saving money, I think the reality is that if there are any savings, they are pretty minimal. And the reports that we've had thus far from a lot of school districts is that they are expecting to end this fiscal year in a deficit situation.
You mentioned a few of these, but tax increases is the obvious answer. But how can that loss of revenue be made up?
I think the reality is that the next school year is going to be very different. And I think it is very likely in most school districts across the state that there will be cuts and reductions to programs and all kinds of things. I think that, you know, $1 billion just at the local level alone is not something that can easily be made up through one sort of uniform plan. So, and that's not even, again, considering what could happen with state revenue for school districts. So the sort of scope of the potential gaps that school districts might be dealing with are pretty significant. And while we know there's a lot of school districts out there that are not going to raise millage rates or they are providing a lot of flexibility, I think the reality is cuts and reductions to programs are likely in a lot of places to be able to sort of make a dent in some of the shortfalls that we're expecting to see in school district revenue.
Ms. Barrick, there are school districts across the state. In fact, I would say the majority of them, and you tell me whether that's accurate or not, that have rainy day funds. And some of them have multi-million dollar rainy day funds. Well, I saw one quote, that there was a legislator said, it's pouring, and it's time to dig into those reserves. What about that?
Yeah, so I think the school districts have about 1.8, based on 17-18 data, $1.8 billion in unassigned fund balance. So that's sort of fund balance that has not been sort of set aside for a particular purpose, a building project or covering increasing pension contribution rates, things like that. And so what we have seen is that, you know, particularly since data just came out over the weekend, last year school districts used, and that amount actually went down. So school districts are using that amount. I think the other really important thing to sort of recognize is that while it sounds like a really big number, equates to about 22 days of operation. So that's it. That's all that school districts have in their reserves. And I think that while we certainly would expect a lot of school districts to tap into that as part of their plan to sort of put together a budget and cover some of these massive revenue shortfalls for next year, I think the reality is there's not an awful lot of money there, and that certainly is not going to sort of plug entirely the hole. I think it's also important to remember that we don't really know what's going to happen next school year yet, and what that's going to look like and what other expenditures may be necessary in school districts to be able to sort of adjust to the new COVID-19 reality. I think it's also important to remember as well that this is not going to be an issue that is sort of contained to one school district fiscal year. I think school districts are likely to feel the impact of this. We certainly know the state will feel the impact of this financially after 2021. So I think that, you know, this is not a one-year event, and so school districts have to also plan accordingly to make sure that they are able to adjust and deal with revenue shortfalls that may occur in the next couple of years.
You said that you're sure that there will be districts that will be tapping into those reserves, but the reality has been that many school districts have been slow to do that. But isn't that the situation like we're in right now what those reserves are for?
Oh, I mean, certainly. I mean, I think school districts are, as I said, data just came out yesterday to sort of show what happened with school districts in 18-19. So that's the most recent available data we have available right now. And that amount of school district sort of unassigned fund balance actually decreased, showing that school districts are using those funds, and they were using them in 18-19. We anticipate that they are continuing to use them. So certainly, I think that a lot of school districts will use a lot of those funds. But I think, again, they have to be very careful, too. This is not a one-year event. And so they have to be very thoughtful about all of this and, again, make adjustments for where they've got increasing costs as well. So I think there are a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of factors that are going to have to be school district specific, but I would expect a lot of school districts to rely on their fund balance as we have seen that they've been doing recently.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, speaking of education, it is Teacher Appreciation Week here in Pennsylvania, actually across the country, and we'll be talking about some teachers and some of the things that they're doing while students are at home during the pandemic. Also coming up on tomorrow's program, The American Lung Association has put out their annual State of the Air report, and it is related to respiratory health, so it does fit into the discussion about COVID-19. So that's coming up on tomorrow's program. Today, our guest is Hannah Barrick, Assistant Executive Director with the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials. That organization has estimated that the Pennsylvania schools are looking at a $1 billion budget shortfall come next year. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Hannah, you mentioned that there may be some cuts if this revenue shortfall isn't fulfilled. And unless there is money coming from the state or the federal government, it's very likely that there will be continue to be a shortfall. I saw an estimate. It's not from your organization, but from another education organization, an estimate that said that Pennsylvania could lose 9,000 teaching jobs, or about 6% of all teachers in the state. Could that be?
Well, so I think if we go back to 2008 again, following that, in the few years during that period, there were about we lost about 20,000 positions in Pennsylvania schools, which was huge, and we still haven't quite recovered at this point back to where we were prior to the recession. I think the reality is, if we still don't know what's going to happen with respect to state revenue. We know there's some federal stimulus funding coming. We don't know how exactly those two things will sort of intertwine, and if school districts will be level funded, if they will be cut, if the stimulus funding will hold them level. It's really unclear exactly how that will work, but I think the reality is $1 billion shortfall at the local level, potentially, plus potentially some state revenue declines, certainly could mean some significant layoffs or furloughs of teachers or other staff. And I think that is something that everybody is really concerned about, and every school district is really scrambling to figure out, how they can kind of piece this budget together with doing sort of minimal or having minimal impact on the actual education that they're going to be providing to students. So that's certainly a challenge, and I'm certain that those discussions are happening in a lot of school districts across the state.
Will this mean bigger class sizes?
Well, I think that's a really big question. I think because we're sort of in this situation where I think in a normal time when we would have this, when we know following the Great Recession in 2008, I think that was the result in a lot of cases. Right now with COVID-19, I'm not really sure you can have bigger class sizes when you're trying to do social distancing. And those are some of the conversations that school districts are thinking through. What does the next school year look like? And how can we put 20 kids in a classroom? And how do we put 72 kids on a bus? And so I don't know. These two things really sort of intersect in a very, very difficult and uncertain way, how you sort of make all of this work. So I don't know the answer to that. I think, less teachers certainly worked out to, having larger class sizes in a lot of places. I think that has to be sort of factored in with how do you do that anyways when we're sort of social distancing and all those conversations just complicate what is already a difficult decision.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, many people, when they do the math, if they see there are fewer teachers, they mean that they automatically assume that means bigger class sizes. But with social distancing, all the things you're talking about, that could be difficult. And a school bus, with two kids to a seat, that's going to be very difficult to do if social distancing continues.
Right, certainly. And even at the elementary level, there's three kids to a seat, right? So it's going to be really, really difficult. And some of those things that we just sort of take for granted about how school districts operate are likely not, at least for the first part of next school year, are going to have to be really called into question and really thought through about, can we do this appropriately? Can we do it the way that we've always done it? Like, what additional precautions can we take? And what are the implications for those? So I think that is another major layer of uncertainty that everybody is thinking through in 500 school districts across the state as they are thinking through how do we make our budget work for next year.
We have an email from our listener, Thomas, And he says, what I see here is just another excuse to raise taxes again and again and again. Now, he lists some of the other things that we've heard, pensions and that kind of thing. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But I'm sure there are people out there, you know, many people in Pennsylvania who obviously do not like tax increases on to get from their school districts every year. But when he says this is another excuse to raise taxes, how do you answer that?
Well, I think the reality is, like, look, I think everybody recognizes that this is an unprecedented financial situation for everybody here. So the state is challenged, school districts are challenged, individual taxpayers are challenged. And so this is something that everybody is grappling with. I think the reality is that school districts are doing a lot to be able to recognize the needs of the needs to have some flexibility for taxpayers. There's a lot of school districts that have already said that they're not going to raise millage rates for next year. There's a lot of school districts that are increasing the number of installment payments. They're waiving the penalty period. They're extending the discount period, just sort of trying to recognize that this is a really, really difficult position for all of us to be in. But I think, again, the reality is, school districts have to be able to operate. They have to be able to educate students. Again, we're in a completely new environment in a completely unprecedented situation right now that everybody is kind of working through sort of on an hourly basis with, changes sort of coming left and right. But I think the reality is, like, there is so much uncertainty, losses in revenues potentially at the state and federal level, and, the local level certainly. We don't have any declines in a lot of these other costs that school districts are dealing with. So we know the pension costs are increasing, special education costs are increasing, charter school tuition costs are increasing, and all of those are happening, completely outside and regardless of the fact that we're dealing with a global pandemic right now. So it is a challenge. It certainly is a challenge, and we recognize that it is difficult for folks at every level here. But I think this is just something that, everybody is trying to grapple with how to make this work, how to be able to, have as many resources as possible to sort of mitigate any educational impact, recognizing that I would be surprised if any school district sort of remained immune from this. So everybody's planning for less revenue from all sides, and it's just going to be a difficult year, certainly for school districts and communities and everybody's impacted by this, certainly.
An idea that has been tossed around in the legislature that would impose a one-year freeze on property tax increases. Your thoughts on that?
So I think that, we certainly have looked at that. And I think the reality is, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of school districts who are sort of financially stable enough that they have reserves, they can make some surgical cuts, that they have already indicated that we're not going to raise millage rates. And school districts, again, are trying to be as sort of sensitive as possible to the challenges that taxpayers are facing. This is certainly something that has reached people in a way that folks have never experienced before. So there are a lot of districts that are trying to do that. And again, there's a lot of school districts that are recognizing that, look, we're going to provide taxpayers with every sort of bit of flexibility to pay. We'll, again, increase the number of installments that they could pay in. We will extend the discount period for payment. We will waive the penalty period for payment and just, again, try to recognize the challenges that a lot of taxpayers are facing. I think, unfortunately, however, not every school district is in a position financially, again, particularly given we don't know what's going to happen at the state level, and we are expecting pretty significant revenue declines at the local level, to say that they can't that they can move forward without a even small millage rate increase. And I think the reality is, this is a decision that should be made by individual school district and their individual community. That's what they have school boards that are elected to do. It's certainly a tough decision, and I know school boards are going to be put in that position across the state. But that's what they're elected to do. And I think the position is, let's not sort of have a state mandated property tax freeze that potentially financially devastates some school districts while we have locally elected officials who are in the position to be able to make that hard decision and that assessment for their community. So I think that is an important component. I think the other thing, too, is, you know, the timing of this is really difficult because school districts, while they're anticipating certainly these local revenue declines, they have no idea what's going to happen yet with state revenue. And so kind of tying their hands before they have a sense of what the state is going to do and what the state is going to be able to fund or not fund really makes what is already a tough conversation that much more difficult.
Our guest, if you're just tuning in, is Hannah Barrick, Assistant Executive Director with the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials. We have a few minutes left in this segment of the program. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. But Ms. Barrick, talking about tax increases, Act One, something that was enacted a few years ago now, that put some rules in place that school districts were limited in the amount of tax increases that they could seek every year, put it that way, or seek in a year. Now, there was, you know, something built into that, a waiver. And I don't know what the percentage is. Maybe you do, but what the percentage of school districts who have asked to go past that limit have been. But it seems that it often, very often, happens. And without that freeze, and you know, this is not just a personal thing. I'm you know, reading a question that some taxpayers would have. That without that freeze, that it's almost a certainty with this kind of budget shortfall that school districts would be looking for tax increases and maybe even past that limit that they're supposed to have.
Well, so I think the reality is that with Act One, there was a process where school districts could apply to the Department of Education for exceptions to exceed their sort of index cap. There used to be, I think, 11 exceptions. That got whittled back to basically two. One is for pension cost increases, and one is for special education increases. The way the pension cost one was written, it is virtually useless at this point. So it doesn't really apply for most school districts anyways. They can't even take advantage of that. So that one is really basically off the table. The only exception that is still sort of actively being used is the exception for special education cost increases, which we know is one of those mandated cost increases that is certainly driving school district budgets on an annual basis. And we, you know, continue to see that, but school districts don't really have an opportunity or an option to say, like, we're not going to pay those costs. If they have a special education student, they have to provide the appropriate programs and services that student requires. I think the other thing that's important to recognize with the Act 1 exceptions is that there are a lot of school districts that apply for them every year. However, the number of school districts that actually use those exceptions to exceed their index is really, really minimal. So there really are just a handful of school districts that are using those exceptions at this point. Most school districts, you know, if they're going to raise their millage rate, they raise it somewhere within the Act 1 index and do not use any exceptions. And so the use of exceptions we have seen falling pretty tremendously over this time period. And again, if a school district didn't apply for exceptions, you know, back in the early winter, they're not going to be able to use them right now. So there's a really, really limited universe of school districts that would even have that on their plate for this fiscal year.
Charter schools. Would you explain the formula for how school districts reimburse or pay charter schools, and with the knowledge, or at least the context, that charter schools will still be and are still being paid at the same rate? What is that formula?
Right. So every year, a school district calculates a charter school tuition rate that they will pay for any student in the district that attends a charter school. And that rate is based on what the school district budgeted for a fiscal year. You take out some things. You take out federal funds because charter schools receive their own federal funds. You take out transportation costs because the school district has the responsibility of transporting the charter school student. And a couple of other expenses that are sort of deducted because a charter school doesn't have sort of equivalent expenditures. But you take that, you divide that sort of on a sort of per student basis based on the number of kids that the school district is financially responsible for, and you come up with a tuition rate per student. You sort of do a similar calculation for a special education tuition rate. So if a resident student from a district is attending a charter school and they have an IEP, they're a special ed student, you're going to pay a higher rate that's based, again, on what the school district is spending to educate its own special education students. So every school district has two rates to pay a charter school, a regular education, special education. The special education is generally about $10,000 higher per student than the regular education rate. And then that is the amount that a school district will pay to a charter school for every student that is going to attend. I think the challenge as we have been looking at this is that that charter school tuition rate and the sort of collective charter school tuition expenditures that school districts have made over the past several years is increasing pretty exponentially. So again, I had mentioned before that we just got the 2018-19 annual financial report data from school districts, and the additional amount that school districts paid to charter schools for that year increased by more than $220 million. So we're in double-digit increases every year. And while there certainly is some charter school enrollment growth, and that's, you know, partially driving this, most of it is driven just as a factor of the mechanics of that formula and how that is calculated. And so as charter school tuition costs grow from 1 year, that's factored back into the calculation for the next year, which increases the tuition rate, which factors back into the calculations, and so on and so on. And I think one of the challenges that school districts are facing, again, going back to their 2021 budgets, is that the charter school tuition rate for next year is going to be based on what school districts budgeted that they would spend in 2019-20. Again, not recognizing, that there would be a pandemic. So they budgeted that. And so the charter school tuition rate is going to likely, you know, increase again, and is going to be really immune from all of the sort of financial challenges that school districts and the state are facing. So that's another layer of uncertainty and difficulty and challenge that school districts are grappling with right now, is that is one mandated cost that is growing really, really rapidly. They're going to have to pay, given the fact now that they're looking at pretty significant declines at the local level and potentially the state level as well.
We're almost out of time for this portion, and I want to thank you very much for being with us today. But just a couple of things to pass along to the audience. There will be some inequity, or there is some inequity in how Pennsylvania schools are funded, so poor districts will be hit harder because they don't have the tax base that a lot of the districts that have more of a tax base and more money to go along with it. And as you could probably hear from Hannah Barrick, there are a lot of people who would like to see that charter school formula changed. Hannah Barrick, Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar, talking about how our lives have been changed. One way that they have been changed is how many of us, probably half the country, if they continue to work, that they are working remotely. When Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf ordered all schools closed in the state in the middle of March, for all intents and purposes, many working families were thrust into teleworking from home and ordered to be with their kids. Stay-at-home orders followed, and nearly 2 months later, more than half of American workers and students are working remotely. Researchers see this abrupt change as an opportunity to study how employees adapt and to identify the innovation that has helped speed this transition. One of those researchers is Dr. Eddie Ng, professor of management at Bucknell University. Dr. Ng, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, maybe there are, we know there are a lot of you out there, but maybe some of you who are working remotely have a question or a comment about it. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Ng, I have to say that, no, this is just a personal thing, that I was a little bit surprised that it's only about half the country that is working remotely. I would have thought that that the percentage would be bigger. Now, maybe that's just if that includes those who are unemployed. But it seems as though, I mean, compared to what was the people who were working remotely before, that that number has increased significantly.
Yeah, it certainly has. And it's a perception that we generally have. The United States as a whole, we haven't been a leader in terms of, you know, what we refer to as telework or working remotely. When the pandemic really hit and, you know, sort of public health officials and, you know, elected leaders start sending us home, it was very sudden. It was very hasty in terms of the implementation. So as a result, a lot of employers are simply, they simply don't have the infrastructure, even though, you know, we were forced to work from home. I mean, just to give you an example, from a survey that was released by the Pew Research Center, only roughly less than 10 million Americans actually work from home. And that translates into 7% of the workforce in the private sector industry. If you look at government workers, both at the local and state level, that's even lower at about 4%. So when we move from 7% to roughly about half the American workforce, that's actually a pretty significant number. And don't forget, it was not a, even though it was very sudden, employers are scrambling to put together. And more employees actually come on, sort of, you know, perform telework over that sort of 1 month period of time as employees sort of figure out how best to accommodate these employees.
When you, okay, so let's talk about that. When you say infrastructure, what specifically are you saying that American employers were missing?
Well, it's not just from the employer side. So when you work from home, you require a technological interface from both ends, right? So the employer must have a system in place. And what's of concern in this day and age is the notion of security. How do the employers protect, sort of the information flow that goes between the company or an employer server and the employee's home? So not everybody has the infrastructure to provide VPN or any sort of security software. From an employee's perspective, depending on when, where they live, they may not have the bandwidth to necessarily connect back to the employer's computer network. So, you know, when you don't have the infrastructure, I mean, very few industries actually have a significant number of employees that work remotely. So when you don't haven't had that infrastructure, you scramble to put those things together. I mean, some industries or some sectors of the economy tend to do better. I mean, what we generally refer to as knowledge work. So if you look at professional and technical work, you know, law firms, accounting firms, consulting firms, they are much more prepared because they have had employees work remotely, you know, from different client sites all the time. But for the rest of the other industries that haven't been exposed to, you know, sort of an event of this magnitude, they just simply don't have the capacity to provide that that technology to support workers working from home.
That security issue that you mentioned, that is obviously something significant for employers to think about. But I often wonder whether it was because there were so many companies, so many employers that were just slow to, I don't know, adapt to technology and say that, you know, this is something that we want to do. You know, they didn't want to get away from the traditional come to work every day, 8 to 5, if that those are your hours, and that somehow they wouldn't be getting the productivity from workers at home that they would be getting in person. Are those factors that many employers were thinking about?
Yeah, you sort of raise an important point here. So the whole notion of telework, you know, promoting work-life balance has been, it's not new. It's been around for more than 2 decades, right? So if you look at European nations, they tend to have a higher proportion of employees working from home, upwards of 20%, especially in Scandinavian countries. So that's sort of a measure of work-life balance that they have. Whereas in the U.S., part of it is the managerial employer, for lack of a better word, distrust. You know, we're not sure whether employees actually will be working if we allow them to work from home. So it isn't so much that the technology hasn't been there. Employers have been slow in adopting those technologies in part because of managerial attitudes up until now when they're forced to do it. So they're concerned about, you know, motivational issues, morale issues, supervision issues. We actually have a really good case study that was done around 2015, I think, when New Zealand had an earthquake in Christchurch. So as a result of that, you know, a lot of employers, government services were done, were offered remotely. So as a result of that, a very small amount of data did come out of it showing that employees actually did have increased productivity, but managers had a harder time coping with working from home or this telework arrangement. So, you know, when you go back to saying, when you ask a question earlier, why haven't we done that? Why are employers not prepared for it? Part of it is the managerial attitude. Part of it is they haven't really had the need to actually incorporate wide use of technology to allow employees to work from home. So this in itself actually exposes a lot of how agile employees are in responding to sort of a crisis, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's a flood situation, whether it's, we have a lot of instances, you know, but they are very isolated. So this is a fairly large scale that actually put employees on notice that it might be time to sort of upgrade their infrastructures and be more prepared.
Anecdotally, I have heard of several instances where, you know, an employee wanted to work remotely or work from home, and the employer was a little bit hesitant about it. But now, since this has occurred, they have found that, that is the employer, has found that it works. And that afterwards, they're saying, you know, we're going to rethink this, and maybe you can work from home more or remotely. Has your research found that there, I mean, it's been a short period of time, 2 months or so, but that there are more employers who have found that this works, and they're more willing to do it?
Yeah, what we have seen, just from the early evidence that's available is, and part of this is to actually capture, you know, two things, whether this working remotely will stick post-pandemic and whether there's going to be an increase or a decrease in productivity. So it's a bit too early to tell. And also, we are sort of in a lockdown situation where we have kids at home or other folks at home that could be a distractor. So, and of course, you're also trapped at home. So if we take away those things, what you might see is that there should be an increase in productivity. So that is very textbook-based or theoretical-based. But there was an incident where I used to work at a financial institution, a major bank, and we have had this work-life balance telework on the books as a policy, a human resource policy. And it is and two employees that want to do that would have to propose to, you know, the unit manager on whether or how they would be able to overcome the operational challenges. And it's up to the manager to actually approve it or not. Now, over 80% of managers decline all this arrangement because managers like to have all the employees present in the workplace, right? But then the HR department actually felt, wait a minute, let's actually switch the onus. Now we want the managers to tell us how or why it will not work. So when the onus is shift from employees having to prove that it works to managers now proving that it does not work, what we found was the incidence of working remotely actually went up. And then we did work remotely survey, and we found that productivity actually increased for two reasons. I mean, number one, employees actually are more productive in the sense that they can co-mingle work with, you know, taking care of little chores. If you are not feeling well, let's say you're mildly sick, you're more likely to take the day off if you have to come into the office. But if you're, you know, if you're not feeling very well or you have a mild illness, you're more likely to continue working from home, right? So those are the little things that we see, and we need to be able to capture more, you know, phenomena like that to actually show that working from home is actually productive and advantageous for the employer. Now, a lot of employees actually prefer working from home, especially after this pandemic. I mean, some work is just more conducive. And of course, certain personality types. If you're an introvert, you would actually hate coming into work once this whole pandemic is over, right? I mean, there's the notion of, you know, The talk about, you know, being able to get from your bed to your desk in virtually 10 minutes as opposed to sitting in traffic for an hour to commute to work, that's an added benefit, you know, not having to sort of buy your lunches. I mean, there are a lot of benefits from working from, you know, remotely, as well as benefits for the employer as well. So all these things are critical for us to crystallize. Now, because the rate, the uptake rate has been so low in the U.S., this is the opportunity for us to actually capture some of the nuances or some of the benefits that we haven't been able to capture, so that, you know, potentially we can make this the new normal where some employees are, who are able to work from home can actually contribute better from a personal perspective and from an employer's perspective.
There actually, and I know this is something that you've researched, that there are some environmental impacts to it, that it's actually better for the environment because you don't have people driving as much.
Yeah, that's actually pretty obvious, right? So
yeah.
When you don't have to commute, you know, oftentimes people don't carpool as much as we would like them to. But if you're no longer commuting to work, you reduce your carbon emissions, your carbon footprint, you're just consuming less. When you're at home, you're much more likely to be able to synergize your consumption rate. Whereas if you go to work, you have to actually, you know, consume a lot more, not just, you know, from a transport perspective, but just from everything else. So there's definitely a lot of environmental benefits that come out of this pandemic. Two things that will emerge, I think, would be how we leapfrog in terms of, you know, how we consume and how we consume energy, especially fossil fuel, because it forced us to do this. Previously, there was no political will for us to do all these things, but now we are being forced to do it. We know that it can happen. It hasn't been a major disruption. The other part, of course, is leapfrogging and technology, right? So one of the things that we uncovered is, given that a lot of employers were not really that prepared to sort of allow employees to work from home, the lack of infrastructure, employees have been incredibly resilient and creative in actually finding different applications out there that can augment what the employers could provide to them. So these are the two positive outcomes that I see coming out of this this pandemic and working from home.
So, Dr. Ring, you're researching this. You have touched on, you've listed many of the findings so far or some of the thoughts going into it. What exactly are you looking for in your research?
Well, what we're hoping to do is, we're looking at the impact of, you know, of this new work arrangement, whether it's going to stick after a period of adaptation. We want to see whether that, you know, there's a productivity gain or loss. We want to see whether, you know, there's innovation that came out of this. Think ways of working that we haven't been able to, that we haven't uncovered or we did not discover up until now. The other thing, of course, is work relationships, right? The lack of physical contact is a concern. That's the morale, the motivation, the supervision, you know, those issues that I've raised surrounding workplace dynamics. So we want to see how employers and employees navigate this and whether that's going to bode well in future. Because if anything, we are going to see working remotely to increase from, you know, about 7% to hopefully double digits. And how employers are able to provide the necessary platform, the necessary support system, human resource policies to make it work for everyone.
Won't the bottom line be, and, you know, I hate to use, you know, put it on one answer, but won't the bottom line most important thing be productivity?
It is. So that is just one of the measures that, that, you know, that we generally point as a benefit of working remotely. There are others as well. I mean, you touch on, you know, environmental impact that is huge, not necessarily from an employee perspective, but from a societal level, but also from an employee perspective, right? You have to look at well-being. What we found is that there are gender differences in terms of working from home, whether men or women tend to sort of, you know, derive a better benefit out of it. So at the moment, it's really mixed because when you work from home and you are also a mother, it's a bit different right now with kids being trapped at home. You have double duties, right? You have to juggle, you know, educating your kids from home, housework, as well as work. But once people are no longer trapped or locked up in their homes, I think it'll be fairly different. So I think we can't just capture everything from a productivity efficiency perspective or the bottom line. Employee well-being actually indirectly contributes to productivity. So when employee feels better, they waste less time commuting, they waste less time, you know, doing other things. You also gain productivity efficiency that way. So I think all in all, we are just using this research to be able to document the benefits so that we can actually get a stronger acceptance of it. And it's going to change how employers, you know, run their businesses as well, right?
Dr. Ng, we have less than a minute, so I have to ask you to be quick with this, but you actually are looking for participants for your research, right?
Yes, thank you. So it would be great if they can come to your website. I noticed you posted a link, or I will tweet this out as well. So what we're trying to do is to compare how the U.S. Performs and responds to, you know, telework relative to Europe. So we have got a site study out in France. We have got Australia.
Dr. Ng,
Singapore as well.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt Dr. Eddie Ng at Bucknell University. Thank you for being with us.